I had several comments during the break, and I really enjoyed them, and I thought they were all good. I can't remember all of them, and some of them were more of a private nature. But one comment that was, well, I had one person come up. I made the comment about, you know, let's try to mix and meet people we don't know. One person came up to me and said, we've come for years, and it took us double-digit years before we really felt like we were part of the group. And they're from an area that's... They were the only ones from their area that were here. But they were persistent, and now they feel it. So it just kind of reinforced that. The other point on that was someone also pointed out, and I didn't, and I think it's a good point, that is, mixing is a two-way street. Not only should we go out and try to meet people that are new, but some of the new people ought to make an effort to get to meet some of us that are here more often. But that's a personality issue many times, because some people are just more comfortable mixing than others. And at different stages in my life, I've been at different places, so I do understand that. What I want to spend a little bit of time on, and not just talking to each other, but I wanted to share a little bit more of what I got, some of the thoughts I got from some of the high school, college, and junior high classes. I've already shared with you several of them, but when I asked them, you know, what do they see as one of the problems, they said keeping our young people, they considered a problem, and they rightly or wrongly tied that to we don't give them enough of the whys. We give them a lot of the whats and not enough of the whys. I'm not saying that's correct. I'm just passing along what they said to me. They also mentioned what they sensed was an inconsistency in prayer, which I didn't know quite what they meant, so I asked them. And what they meant was they hear a lot of good public prayers, but not too many private prayers. That may be a commentary on the home more than anything else. I don't know, but I don't know where else they would miss private prayers, so I pass that along to you. And also they hear a lot more of thankfulness for physical things in our prayers than thankfulness for spiritual things in our prayers. So you can keep that in mind. I don't want to say which group this was. Both the junior high and the high school came up with very, very similar things. Things they felt we did good in doctrinally, in terms of adhering to. They thought our prayer life was good. We do a good job with communion every first day of the week. Mutual ministry, they thought we did a good job practicing that. And they felt we did a good job standing against sin. We'll talk a little bit more about that. That may be a two-edged sword. When I asked them about why they thought people chose certain churches to go to, they mentioned things like the size of the church, the beliefs of the church, how much entertainment there is, how much sin can be allowed before you get in trouble, peer pressure. Everyone's welcome at some churches, even when they have sin in their lives, youth groups, that type of stuff. So I don't know that I got anything that really surprised me. One that we will talk about, maybe we can start with this, I guess it doesn't matter. They felt we are not good at confessing our sins one to another. That passage in James chapter 5, you know, confess your faults one to another. I think we all kind of struggle with that. How often and how reticent. But I thought that was a valid point that they made. Probably many of us are quite hesitant to do that. And I don't really know where to come down on that issue, because we could just have a flood every service because we've all made mistakes. But there is maybe a loss in that area, because we are embarrassed, or when people do come forward, they are sometimes very vague in what it's about. So you may not even know what they're talking about, other than that they did something wrong. It seems to me like there is a place in both our prayers and in our confessions, even if it's one to another, for an appropriate specificity. So that at least the congregation knows if there's a certain area, or we admit it to God in our private prayers. It may not be a public confession. But they felt, and I think they have a valid point, and they weren't casting stones. They were just sharing because I kind of made them. They don't see much of that. And when a young lady goes forward, everyone assumes what it's all about. And that may or may not be what it's all about, but assumptions are made. And the idea, we tend to go forward when we've gotten caught rather than when we've sinned. And I know that's probably true. That's probably true. Eric's back. Thank you. Thank you. Amen, Corner. Okay. I guess if I was to say one of the areas that doctrinally, and I think it's a doctrinal issue, that kind of umbrellas all of this is we spend a lot of time looking for loopholes rather than figuring out what we need to do to correct. And if we maybe spent more time correcting than looking for loopholes, we'd all be better off spiritually. I looked up loophole, and it's an ambiguity, especially one in the text of the law or contract that makes it possible to evade a difficult situation or obligation. And there is a real human tendency for us to look for loopholes. I believe the strength of the church lies in its virtue and not in its strategies. I'm going to repeat that. And that's not original with me, I just forgot where I heard it. The strength of the church lies in its virtue, not in its strategies. Another way of saying that, I think the real strength of the church lies in its purity and adhering to what the New Testament teaches. I also believe the great attractiveness of the church lies in that. And sometimes maybe we have a tendency to slide on the church's virtue and try to make up for it in our strategies or our plans. That does not mean that strategies, plans, and whatever are inappropriate. We need to be organized, but it will never take the place of virtue. Never underestimate man's ability to rationalize what we want to be true. And you see this often, and I'm not thinking of anybody or any particular congregation, of how different things happen when they're ours. Maybe they're our physical family. Maybe it's somebody we've worshiped with for years. It becomes very, very difficult sometimes to deal with some of these situations. I wrote down a few things that I've gotten from either my own mind or from talking to some of you that I thought we'd spend a little bit of time on, and then I'm going to give you a chance to comment as you choose to or not after I've made a couple of comments. Doctrinal areas that we need to be very careful with, and maybe I could say we as a brotherhood struggle with. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Church discipline, number two. Number three, 2 John 9, not bidding Godspeed to those who are not teaching the truth. Well, let me just stop with those. Well, no, number four, dress. That was one that I touched on a little bit in the first hour. Number five, attendance. This was one that was given to me. And then I mentioned number six, confessions that either don't occur or are so broad that they really leave the matter in disguise. Let me go back and comment on the first one. I don't know of very many congregations, and I don't remember how many years ago, but that was part of my assignment a few years ago to discuss marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And it just continues to really be a bane in our society, and it continues to be a bane in the church. How many families, how many men are otherwise seemingly could be good officers in the church, but because of various aspects of this, maybe it would not work out. Congregation after congregation, I think, is eager for new scriptural leadership. And this is often one of the things, maybe the most frequent thing, that causes problems. For me, intellectually, this is not a difficult issue. Emotionally, sure, it becomes hard when it's people we love. But Jesus addresses it twice, pointedly. In Matthew chapter 5, and I'll read these verses, not because they're unfamiliar, but because it is such an issue. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 31 and 32, "Whosoever shall put away or divorce his wife and give her a writing of divorcement, I say unto you that whosoever shall put his wife away except for the cause of fornication causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery." He addresses it again in Matthew chapter 19, and he says almost identical to what I just read to you from Matthew chapter 5, when in verse 9 he says, "Whosoever shall put away his wife except for fornication and shall marry another committeth adultery, and whoso marrieth her which is put away also commits adultery." I'm not the most brilliant person in the world, but I think I understand what he's saying. If you get divorced for any other reason than sexual infidelity of your mate, you're not in a position and they're not in a position to remarry. I don't know any other way to read that. Now, I do understand that the other passage that often comes into this is 1 Corinthians chapter 17, and chapter 7, which essentially says, if you're abandoned, if your mate leaves you, you're freed from that. And I'll turn and read that and then give you my understanding of it, not to be controversial, but to address an issue that really is wreaking havoc in our brotherhood because we're human beings. Verse 15, "If an unbeliever depart, let them depart. The brother or sister is not under bondage. In some cases, God has called us to peace." If you have a mate that abandons you, it's talking there about an unbeliever, but if we have a mate that abandons us, we are no longer under bondage. My understanding of that passage is you are no longer under the marriage bondage. He talks earlier in that passage about responsibilities we have to our mates as husbands and wives. But I don't find any place in 1 Corinthians 13 that talks about remarriage. And I know there are people who believe, and I know that there are probably people here who believe, and that's, you have a right to understand scriptures as you choose to. But I don't understand this to at all give a person the right to remarry just because they have been abandoned or they have been left. That, to me, would contradict the words of Jesus. Unless or until there is sexual infidelity in a relationship, the right to remarry doesn't exist. Now, is that hard? It sure is. And I ache for people that are in those kinds of dilemmas that I would probably have to advise celibacy to. But as hard as that might be, and I really do appreciate how difficult that can be in some cases, it's not near as difficult as being disobedient to the Lord in the judgment day. That is what is really difficult. But it is wreaking havoc. I've this year, and I'm sure other evangelists and some of you elders in your own congregations can relate to it. I'm thinking of one case where an elder and his family left a congregation because there was discipline in some of this area on their family members. And that's very, very sad. I understand that it must be hard when it's those that we love. I have great admiration for all of you leaders in your congregations, official or unofficial pillars, who can stand for the truth even when it hurts. And by that I mean even when it's people that we love. But it seems to me like standing for the truth in these cases not only affects people's souls, it affects our congregation, it affects the message we are sending to our young people. If we're not going to uphold what the Bible says in these areas, I don't know what we say to our young people when they have difficulties in it. I don't know how we would be credible. Now, I'm going to pause, and I know that's kind of a third rail. I understand that, and I won't feel bad if nobody has anything to say. I would feel bad if I didn't say what I believed the Bible taught. Okay. Where we at here? Oh, I'm sorry, Jason.
Back, is there any specificity that has to do with just women? Or is that just men and women?
In terms of being free to remarry?
Fornication.
I'm sorry?
Fornication.
Okay, put a verb with that, Bill.
No, sorry. Well, the statement kind of implies if the wife would commit fornication, you know, but
okay.
It would be the husband also, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's gender specific. I think that applies to all of us. There's neither male nor female, so I understand that to be, I would take that to be gender encompassing. Cliff? Just a minute, we're not getting you.
I can't remember exactly where it is in the Bible, but it says in there that when the mate dies, you are free.
Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. I did not cover that. It's not an issue of divorce and remarriage, but when our mate dies, I believe in Romans and in Corinthians, you are then free to remarry. Yes. Josh?
When Paul wrote that an elder had to be a husband of one wife, I think that what he's talking about is having been faithful to a wife rather than not ever having been loosed from a wife by a legal avenue. That's a problem in our churches, is that we seem to put a cultural boundary on who can or cannot be an officer in the church, and it's based off of Roman Catholic teaching on divorce, that there is no divorce in the New Testament. And I'd also like to say that on 1 Corinthians chapter 7, if a man is unbound from a wife, or if a woman is unbound from a man, how does that not cause them to be free to remarry? You don't have to answer that, because there are going to be hundreds of answers that I'll probably hear later.
Okay.
But that's
you want to stand up so they can all see who you are?
All right.
That's Josh.
If you've got any eggs, here I am.
I'm kidding. He's cool.
Yeah. The definition that God gives to a marriage is many things, some of which encompasses, it involves conjugal rights and things such as that. Sure. If a woman's not being provided for financially or sexually, it's not a marriage. It is dissolved. And therefore, if we set up separate dwellings, that's what some people have as a partial answer to not divorcing but separating, it's still a violation and an adulteration of the marriage contract.
Okay. I'm not sure I disagree or agree with you, because I'm still trying to figure out exactly where you're at. But I'll just reemphasize, I understand the being free to being free from the marriage contract. I just don't see anything in that passage that frees me up, that I would, in my conscience, be able to remarry. Because Jesus said, save for fornication. And I don't want to add to what Jesus said unless, if Paul had said, you are freed from your marriage and can remarry, then I'd be on board. But I don't see it there personally. And I forget what else you might have asked me, so that's okay. I'll think of it, maybe. Anybody else want to comment, that, especially someone that hasn't? I just think we need to be very, very careful on this, because if it's just so human to want to make it say what we so bad want it to say. We just need to be very careful about that.
I understand that the marriage is... it's a covenant with the Lord.
It's a covenant with the Lord and with our mates.
Right. So we need his permission.
Yeah. The discussion is, does that give us permission or not? I don't think it does. We got one behind you, and then we'll take a couple more. Chad and Elijah, and then I don't want to cut it off, but we could spend all week on this. I know we could.
I've never understood there in Matthew when Jesus says causes her to commit fornication. It almost sounds like it's inevitable, and I didn't know if that was because of the custom of the day that she would be handed to someone else or not.
I don't take that in Matthew 19 as saying that is inevitable. It says, whosoever marrieth her would just put away. The human tendency is, especially if you're younger, and back then probably there were some even more financial reasons for needing to remarry. But once a relationship is broken for a reason other than fornication, then the adultery or the fornication or the adultery would come in once one remarries. If one is divorced and doesn't remarry, I wouldn't see any adultery or fornication happening if one kept themselves chaste and pure. Elijah?
Yeah, my thought is, well, first off, I don't have anything to enlighten on any loopholes as far as an understanding on whether you can remarry or not, but all too often society pushes on to couples and to people that all you really need is love in them to make a marriage. But the truth is, when you go back to the Word of God, it shows the importance of understanding the contract that you're choosing to get into.
Yeah.
It emphasizes the importance of it. I didn't understand this as much when I made the choice as much as I do now, but it seems to be that it needs to be preached on more or pushed more or talked about more with younger couples so that they'll understand there are consequences for their actions, if that's one way you want to view it.
I think that's well said, and if you're in the category of people that didn't understand it well when you got married, welcome to the club. Anybody that says they did really understand it when they got married is probably delusional, in my humble opinion.
I truly think that we need to, you know, preach that more and try to make that as well understood as possible.
And I would only amend, and you will agree with this amendment, we should probably teach it before they become couples. Because once somebody has fallen in love, once the hormones are pumping, the mind shuts down. And it takes a few years before your mind clears. So we need to teach it. And David had a reference to that in his devotional this morning, not being unequally yoked together. You know, the time to persuade someone in the faith is before we say I do, not after we say I do, if that's what is needed. It doesn't mean it can't work the other way. It just means I believe it's quite dangerous the other way. One more. I don't know where we're at. Where are we at? Oh, Charles?
Yeah, the other verse I wanted to ask you about was 1 Corinthians 7, 27.
Okay.
Where it says, art thou bound unto a wife, seek not to be loosed. Art thou loosed from a wife, seek not a wife. But if thou marry, thou hast not sinned.
Okay, what verse did you say?
27, 28.
27 and 28, chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians.
Okay, I understand verse 27 to say, if you're married, don't look to get out of your marriage. These people, many of them were probably married to unbelievers because the gospel was new. And so one mate would become a Christian and the other one wasn't. Don't divorce your mate just because they're not a Christian. Stay with them. And then in verse 28, if you marry, I must be talking to single people because married people would already be married. If you married, it's not a sin to marry. Now, I think Paul maybe underneath this had a sense that the church was going to have a lot of persecution, and he may have even had a sense that Christ was going to come relatively soon. So marriage might have been a hindrance. If you're going to be persecuted, thrown in jail, killed, having a family, I would think would be a burden, if I could use that word. It's an additional thing for you to talk to. Have you got a follow-up? Maybe I didn't understand your question.
No, I was just thinking about the last part of 27 there where he says, art thou loosed from a wife, which I would assume means the same thing as the earlier loosed, meaning divorce. Art thou loosed from a wife, seek not a wife, but if thou marry, thou hast not sinned.
Okay. My personal understanding of that is that these were people who maybe had been married, weren't married, they came in and became a Christian, and then were in a position to, if they chose to, marry. There's a lot of different thoughts about whether baptism washes away your past marital relationship. I tend to think that it might. And that's a fudge answer, I know, when you say might. But I think baptism may well wash away our past. That's quite different than a Christian who gets divorced, in my opinion. Because I believe as Christians we are held to a different standard than the world is held to. Not in that we have to do the things different to be saved. I just think we should know, and we're held to that standard. Now, I'll be happy. I'll be here the rest of the day in hiding. And so if you can find me, no, I'll be here. This is a hard issue. I wouldn't have had it on my list if it was an easy issue. I'm just saying it's one that we really need to watch the scriptures on, because it's a real tendency to want to, for want of a better word, it's not a theological word, it's the one we want to fudge on if we're not careful. Okay, let me move to one that's similar, and I just call this church discipline. We've got numerous congregations represented here, and I'm not talking about discipline on marriage, divorce, any more than anything else. Some of you, in my estimations, do a wonderful job in keeping the church, your congregations, as pure as you can. But I see numerous congregations that really struggle with even disciplining open sin. And I think it's one of the doctrinal issues that our brotherhood and other denominations too, but I'm not worried about them now, I'm worried about us, really struggle with the concept of overlooking, sweeping it under the rug. I go to congregations and they haven't disciplined anybody for 40 years. Well, that's wonderful if nobody in that congregation ever needed to be disciplined. It's just a little hard for me to think that that's true. And you have to judge this in your own hearts. But this is a hard thing for congregations, and it's a hard thing for the eldership. It's not a pleasant thing to do. But it strikes me that the early church had lots of problems. We tend to think the early church was just euphoric and skip-to-maloo, my darling. I think they had the same problems we have. But I think there was a conscious effort, at least on the apostles and in their doctrinal writings, to keep the church pure. And if we don't keep the church pure, and part of that's going to have to be disciplining each other when there are issues, then why should somebody want to be part of an impure church? Because an impure church is really kind of an oxymoron. Now, all churches have their imperfections. James Wilson was a psychologist or sociologist, probably at UCLA, and he made an observation on urban life that I've always thought maybe applied to us in the church. He said, the crime rate, I quote, "The crime rate escalates on those streets where broken windows are not repaired. Failure to replace broken windows in an urban neighborhood makes an announcement to the public that the standards have been lowered and authority abandoned." He said, "I see such practices of disrepair as an invitation for further crime without the threat of adverse consequences." Well, that reminds me of a passage in Ecclesiastes. Unless the sentence is executed against them swiftly, they are encouraged to sin. Now, I paraphrased that just a little bit, but that's in Ecclesiastes. I think it's chapter 8, but I didn't write it down. 8 or 9. You know, if we don't uphold the standards of doctrine that the Bible teaches us, be it morality or false teaching, and if we don't address them, we are just enabling, encouraging ourselves and others not to adhere to them. And it becomes very difficult once we have set that pattern not to deal with it. As I said, there can't be two right answers. There can only really be one right answer in an arena of doctrine. Three of the things that most plague our society from an attitudinal standpoint, and if we're not careful, will plague our churches from an attitudinal standpoint, are number one, open-mindedness, number two, total acceptance, and number three, privacy. And what I mean by those, if I could just comment on them very briefly, open-mindedness is one of the highest virtues that our society has. I don't know that it's the highest virtue that the church has, however. It's the concept that today there is no such thing as absolute truth. Rick touched on that very briefly yesterday. What's true for one may not be true for another. That's pluralism. That's postmodernism. The truth is relative to the circumstances, and the truth is constantly changing. We talked a little bit about that this morning when I talked about syncretism. But sadly, that mindset can creep into the church. So much that for all practical purposes, the concept of church discipline can disappear. Most of us don't like conflict, but we should be in conflict with sin, not in conflict with the sinner. We need to help one another. The second one is total acceptance. We are encouraged in our society to demand or accept the behavior of those around us, and the cry is tolerance. But the price of intolerance is to be called ignorant or even a bigot. And we hear the mantra, judge not lest you be judged. Well, when we apply the doctrinal standards of morality and worship to one another, we're not judging. We're simply applying the judgments God's already made. If you correct me because I'm stealing, you're not judging me. You're just applying God's judgments to me. Many church members today view membership as their right. I don't believe church membership is a right. I believe it is a privilege. And with membership, therefore, comes responsibility and accountability, which may explain why some people don't become members of local congregations. They don't want to be responsible or accountable. Parents are expected to exercise discipline over their children, and I believe God commands, he doesn't suggest, but he commands that the local congregation exercise discipline and accountability over its members. One of the reasons church discipline has often gone to the wayside is that we become afraid of being labeled judgmental, or we become afraid of driving somebody away. Well, I don't want to drive anybody away, but I don't want to lose my soul because you were afraid to correct me, and I don't want you to lose your soul because I was afraid to correct you. The third one that I mentioned is privacy, and this is the concept of stay out of my life. It's private. In America, privacy has been elevated to constitutional status in most people's mind. Many current issues hide behind privacy. Abortion hides behind privacy. What I do with my body or a woman does with her body is nobody's business. Sexual orientation, what happens behind closed doors is nobody's business. Well, that's not what the Bible teaches, is it? We are brothers and sisters in Christ, and we need to care for each other. I hope that you love me enough to correct me when I need it. I hope I have enough courage, and David talked about profiles of courage this morning. I hope I have enough courage to be able to do the same for you. If we don't really love each other. That's the bottom line. Issues of privacy can also invade the home. Kids will say to their parents, you have no right to invade my privacy. If your kids are living under your roof, you've got every right to invade their privacy because you're responsible for them. And I think you'll be held accountable for them. The idea, however, of privacy can invade the church. And when that happens, churches become thermometers reflecting their environment rather than thermostats setting the environment. And I believe the Bible should set the environment, and we as Christians in our homes and our congregations should set the environment, not simply respond to our environment. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 12 and 13, for what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church that you are to judge? We have an extra accountability and responsibility for each other. We have a responsibility for sharing the gospel to those outside of the church. We have a responsibility for upholding the morals and the doctrines of the church within our church and within us. He goes on to say, God judges those outside, but you purge evil from among you. And that is right on the tails of 1 Corinthians 5, where they had to discipline the man for seemingly an immoral sexual relationship that the church had condoned, maybe under or overlooked, maybe under the heading of love. Well, love never overlooks sin. Cowardice overlooks sin, but love never overlooks sin. Okay, that was a little bit of a soapbox, but we need to be very careful about that. And if you're in a congregation that maybe has been a little lax in church discipline, well, as a member, you can help change that. If you're an officer in that church, deal with it. God doesn't say how long you do before you discipline somebody, but in Matthew 18, it says you go one-on-one, then you go a couple of you to talk, and then eventually it comes to the congregation. But there does seem to be a process and an order, and this is important for the church to remain the church. I guess I feel that that's what I'd like to say. Let me stop and see if anybody has a comment on the general area of church discipline that I sense is something that numerous of our congregations struggle with. Okay, we got one over. Is that Darrell? Okay, got your hat on. I couldn't quite get you. There you go.
Would you comment on 1 Peter 4:17 in the context of what you just been talking about?
I'll try. 1 Peter 4:17. For the time has come that judgments must begin at the house of God, and if it first begin at us, what shall the end of them that obey not the gospel of God? Well, I would want to take that as to being consistent with what I just said, unless you have a different angle. You know, this is a little bit like the beam and the moat that Jesus had in the Sermon on the Mount. You know, you investigate yourself before you go condemning others, but God's going to not condemn us. God's going to judge us all. But it begins in the house of the Lord. And if we don't have our house tidy, or as tidy as we can, not perfect, because we're all humans, if we don't have it, then I don't know that we're in a position to expect people to want to be part of us, because we're no different. Did you have another thought? Okay. I would take that as complimentary. Dace, what you got? Oh, Thomas?
The passage you're looking for in Ecclesiastes was 8 and 11.
Okay, would you read that? Or do you have it?
I have it. I brought my Bible. It came
okay.
in handy.
Thomas got a new Bible. I'm really, really looking forward to this.
Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil.
Okay, and it's just a simple principle. If we say something's wrong and then we don't react when it's done, then fork and tongue, for want of a better expression. And that's not a real theological term, but it expresses what I'm thinking. Anybody else care to make a comment? Okay, let me talk a couple of more here that I told people. I'm sorry, where are we at? Okay, Dale?
Just a comment, not a question.
Good.
We find when we see something that's wrong and we don't speak out against it, we are in fact condoning it.
We are, in fact, enabling it at a minimum. Yeah, I think we need to be careful about this. Some of us may be held accountable not simply for what we have said, but for what we haven't said. Now, speaking the truth in love, and that's a real challenge, but it's a real important part of it. But you can't have truth without love. When you go to 2 John and 3 John, one book they had love without truth, and the other book they had truth without love. Neither one of them worked, and that's why we have 2 and 3 John, in my opinion. Okay, a couple that maybe, I don't know that they'll take less time. These were mentioned, this one was mentioned by the young people, dress. I don't really know what to say on it that I haven't said. We are told to dress modestly, which means dress in a way that doesn't call attention to yourself. That's the technical term of what it means. We normally think of dressing modestly, as we see admonished in the letters to Timothy, as dressing in a way that is not provocative. Well, I think that certainly is included. And ladies, it's not necessarily fair, but you have an additional responsibility to the men, just because men react differently than women to visual stimuli. Okay? It's kind of like, and I've used this, and it's not original with me, you know, men and women are different sexually. Women are like a crock pot. They have to warm up. Men are like a microwave. You just push a button and they're ready to go. We do affect one another differently. And ladies, please don't dress, and I'm being repetitive a little bit to what Rick said, but that's okay. Do not dress in a way that hinders anybody's spirituality and their focus. I think that is a loving thing to do. Men, we need to do the same thing. And we don't tend to do it with skimpiness, but we can do it in other ways, in ways that are distracting or ways that are rebellious. I don't really care if you wear slacks or blue jeans to church. I think God does care about one's attitude. If I wear blue jeans because I know you don't want me to, and it's a stick it in your face type of an attitude, then I got a problem. That's wrong. But both can be modest. Do I have a preference? I sure do. But part of that preference is because of my age. That's the way I was raised. But I can't bind my preference on you. But let's be considerate one of another. There have been times, and I alluded to this the first hour, and I'm glad to say it today because it's cool and there's none of it. There have been times when I have been concerned about the dress at this campout. I will say that point blank. There have been a couple of times I wondered if I should come back. I have, and I don't think not coming back would be the right attitude on my part, or I guess I wouldn't have, but it's been worrisome to me. And it's not just the teenagers. So examine ourselves, and I'll just kind of leave it at that. There's no, I can't say this is too short or that's too short or whatever, because God doesn't. But I think a little common sense and consideration is appropriate. I know congregations that are struggling with this in their assembly. And I think there is a point, and this is a judgment call by the leadership, there is a point in which they should stand for something that they are comfortable with as being appropriate. I can't tell you what that is. I know what I feel it is, but I can't bind that on you. But probably most of you here have been in worship assemblies that you have had an uncomfortability because of some form of dress. Maybe not. Maybe it's just me. But I don't think I'm that different than you are. Okay, now that's a big third rail, so if anybody wants to touch that one, I'm happy. If not, I'm also happy. Seems like when I want to preach on that, it's either winter and it's irrelevant, or it's summer and it's kind of like gluttony. I don't know when to preach on gluttony. Do I do it Sunday morning before the basket dinner, or do I do it Sunday afternoon after the basket dinner? Either way, I'm stuck because I went through twice. I didn't go through just once.
John,
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Jeff Davis.
Yeah.
What's your take on Paul's, when he's writing to Timothy and he uses specifics, braided hair, gold, and pearls? Is there any reason for specifics, or is that just something of the age at that time?
Well, I think the principle there is, well, there are probably two principles. One is doing it in a way that attracts attention to yourself, and apparently those things attracted. There's another train of thought that may have been the way some of the prostitutes dressed back then, so it would obviously be unbecoming. I take it as a principle. Don't adorn yourself in ways that draws attention to yourself and away from the Lord. I personally have no objection to women having braided hair, because I don't find that a distraction. I think there was a cultural aspect there. Would be my comment. Jeremy, you got a comment on that? Okay, okay, well, go ahead anyway.
This concept of modesty for me with having all daughters is something that we have to deal with a lot. And I think that this touches on the concept that you mentioned before about putting reasons to the rules, you know, and I'm, it's almost a plea to other parents to help us out in this regard, because this can potentially be a serious thing because of the effect that it has on the men, and we need to appreciate that and understand it, and those are the reasons, you know, as my daughters get older, to explain those reasons. And it's not comfortable conversations to have, but it helps them out, and it's just asking for help, you know, for the fathers to stand up and to explain that there are reasons to this, and to help the rest of the men of the congregation out, so that it's not a distraction, so that it's not difficult to be in church.
Thank you. Spoken as a man that has daughters. I had none, so I don't face it quite like you do. You swim in a sea of estrogen, and I appreciate that. But Donna swam in a sea of testosterone, so we all have our burdens to bear. Yeah, that may be a real application of Titus chapter 2, the older women teaching the younger women. This is a real area where I think That's not the only thing that means, but it's a real area where we can be of help to one another. And I was talking to somebody at the break. I think it was Tim, but it was several of us. It's sometimes so helpful for our young people to hear it from someone other than or in addition to their parents. You as a father can say something to your family. I as a non-member can say it to your children, and they will hear it differently. But I think that's reversed. If you say it to my sons, they'll hear it differently than me. They need to hear it from both. But this is part of that extended family helping one another. Because it's good for them to hear not just from mom and dad, but from other people that they admire and look up to. I learned a lot from my dad, but I learned a whale of a lot from people that weren't my dad, who were saying the exact same thing my dad was saying. I was just more willing to listen to them. We'll take one more. We got Fred here in the middle, Jason. I'm sorry. Eric.
Yeah, I just got back, and you're going to pass over me.
No. This is not the Passover.
Yeah, all right. I appreciate your response in regards to Jeff's reference to 1 Timothy chapter 2 in regards to some of the specifics that Paul mentioned to Timothy. And I think that sometimes we may look at these scriptures and say, okay, and I appreciate the fact because I agree with you. I think that it was a reference to prostitutes and a certain strata of society. And I think that we need to make it usable for us today where we have celebrities who are celebrity for no other reason than having released a sex tape. And now they have become the standard of celebrity, and they are the standard of fashion and style. They have their own lines of clothing and perfumes and these things for doing nothing except for being emulated for things that are worldly. And so there is a parallel for us where who are we emulating? Who are we following after in our fashion in particular concerning this question? And we really need to pause and ask ourselves, who are we emulating by dressing like this? And why are we doing that?
Yeah. Who are we emulating and why are we doing it? I think not empathy, because I don't shop for women's clothes, but sympathy. I've been told that you mothers, it's hard to find modest apparel in the stores for your daughters. And that may be true, but there's a way to skin that cat somehow. Fred?
I just wanted to comment on several times you mentioned, and I think correctly, the idea of teaching the why. To reinforce that from the standpoint of, I guess, a class I took when I was working for the railroad in business writing. And one of the principles that they put forth in there was the idea of what's in it for me. When you write instructions to reinforce that, to get compliance, you have to tell them what's in it for me. Why would I do this? And I think that applies to our teaching as well.
Okay, thank you. And I think I want to emphasize, we need to understand the situation because that should affect not our message, but our approach. Sometimes people will do things simply because they don't understand the scriptures or it hasn't been pointed out to them. There, I think we should just gush with patience and love, as opposed to someone who's doing it that understands and is just being rebellious. Now, we should still do it with love, but it takes a different form. I've seen people dress, I think, maybe not quite modestly, but they just hadn't stopped to think about it. Maybe they're new to the church. Maybe they're, I don't know, that's totally different. It's a different approach, and I think we need to keep that in mind because I do things when I don't realize it, and I appreciate you being kind to me, and goodness knows you've been kind, had to be kind to me many times, probably kinder than you should have been. I'll accept that. Okay, let me bring up one other one, and then we've got about 10 minutes left. An elder brought this one up, I thought was interesting, attendance. And his comment was, we are no longer a brotherhood that feels that attendance at all the services should be our goal. Well, that's probably true. Now, I don't know how much of a change that is, because 50 years ago, I don't know if Wednesday night, Sunday night, or whatever was any different than it is now. Maybe it was just because there aren't as many pulls. But maybe now it's the pull of a soccer and little league game, and back then it was the pull of getting the cows in to milking them. I don't mean that to be facetious. There were just different issues. But my belief on attendance is that obviously we are commanded to assemble on the first day of the week. So that for me is a no-brainer. What about other times? Well, I don't take the position personally that you have to necessarily be there every time there is an activity. But if the eldership and the congregation has agreed that we're going to meet for worship or Bible study these times, as part of the family, I have a responsibility to you to support that and to my leadership to support that, even if it's not always convenient. Now, there are times when maybe it's unavoidable, be it work or an emergency, but the idea of just Sunday morning, to me, is problematic. To me, that if we're not careful, that becomes, what's the minimum I have to do in order to stay on the rolls? Well, if that's our approach, then we're probably... Now, as teachers at those various times, the more interesting and stimulating we can make the class, obviously, the better it is in terms of edification. But there are times when I go, there are times when you go, and we need to have the idea I'm there to try to encourage others as much as be encouraged. So I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir when I say that, because you wouldn't be here probably if that was your dominant mindset. But I do think that's something that we do need to watch. And certainly, forsaking the assembly on the first day of the week, I think that is a real doctrinal issue. While I'm on that issue, and this is a bit of my personal belief, but in Matthew chapter 18 it says, where two or three are gathered together, I am in their midst also. Please don't take that out of context. What he was talking about was church discipline. And he's saying, if several of you are together and you have to exercise discipline, I'll be with you. He is not saying, if you want to forsake the assembly on the first day of the week because you'd rather be somewhere else and there's two or three of you, you go have church wherever you want to. That is not what he's teaching. If you want to find another scripture to support that, God bless your efforts. I haven't found it. But for me, this is me. I'm not going to bind it on you. I'm just asking you to consider it. Be my luck, if I chose to be somewhere on vacation and forsake the assembly on the first day of the week, that'd be the day the Lord had come. And I don't know what I'd tell him. Okay, this was more important. Am I condemning those who do it? I'm just asking you to thoughtfully think about it, and let's work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. But that could be a loophole if we're not careful. I've heard that passage used so many times, I believe, out of context. He is talking about church discipline and the group being together to discipline one another when it was necessary. He is not giving us license to worship just when and wherever we want. Yes, we can worship anywhere we want, but we need to be assembled with the brethren and partake of the Lord's Supper, I believe, on the first day of the week. I've got one other down here, but I'm not going to go to it unless there are no comments on that one.
This is just something for you to think about. Been in the studies where it's brought up, what is the difference between worship and Bible study? And I don't want you to go into a big thing now, but just something to think about. Maybe you come up with a writing on that or something.
Okay, I'll think about it. That's a big subject. He said, is this a worship? Yes. I would consider this a worship. Someone asked me to comment on translations. Well, there are multiple good translations and there are multiple bad translations. The wrong translation is to only look at one, because I don't know of any translation that is always perfect. I tend to use the King James from the pulpit, New King James, a Revised American Standard, ESV, some of you are using NIV. I can find problems with all of those. But I think if you take some of those reputable ones and study from multiple ones, you'll get the essence. There are some wrong translations that are simply doctrinally incorrect. And I think you can understand them. The Living Bible is not even a translation. It's a paraphrase. The Message is not a translation. It's a paraphrase. If you want to use those for bedtime stories in the Old Testament for your kids, fine. But don't use them for a real doctrinal Bible study. So you're going to have to use some judgment on that. The last thing I wanted to say, besides you're dismissed, is why do we have these issues? Why do we struggle with this? I thought a lot about that the last few weeks since I got this assignment. I think we have lost largely a healthy fear of God. I don't think we fear God like we ought to. We have redefined fearing God into reverent awe. Fearing God, yes, includes reverence and awe, but I find in the Bible many times when it says fear God, the people actually trembled. And I believe maybe I, you, all of us, some of the reasons we struggle with some of these issues and some of the reasons we rationalize some of these things, we have lost a healthy fear for God. God is loving. He needs our reverence. But he exercises wrath on those who disobey him. And we need to never forget that. And I just have to feel that sometimes when we struggle with some of these practical issues, it's that we fear the reaction of people more than we fear the reaction of God. And let us never do that. Because that is a downward spiral that really has a bottom that ends in the pits of hell. We need to be loving. I'm not talking about being harsh. And some of you would consider me to be harsh. Well, I hope you don't, but I understand that. But when the people surrounded Mount Sinai, that wasn't just reverence and awe, that was fear. When the church met in Acts chapter 5, after Ananias and Sapphira had been killed, it says, and fear, that wasn't just awe and reverence. That was a healthy fear of what God will do when we're not obedient. I understand that it says in 1 John, perfect love casts out fear. My belief of that is we need to fear enough what God will do to us if we don't obey, so that we will obey, so we don't have to fear him in the judgment day. And if we don't fear him, what he can do to us and will do to us, we probably won't obey in the way that will keep that from all coming our way. Should we shake and shudder and quiver at the thought? No, God doesn't want us to live our lives that way. But we do need to have an understanding, I believe a healthy understanding, of what it means to fear the Lord. And that will help us in our family issues, our discipline issues, and our dress issues, etc., etc., etc. Okay, we've got maybe 1 minute before anybody comes back. If anybody has a comment, we will take it. Otherwise, we're done. We got a comment. Charles.
Yeah, I just want to comment back. You were talking about the dress and the modesty. I believe it's extremely important. Well, two things. One is it's a generalization that men are affected by sight and women are not. So don't assume just because it's a guy or a woman that she's not affected by that. Two, we need to train our sons to be in control of their mind with God's help, in control of their mind regardless what walks across in front of them, because they will encounter it in the world if they don't count congregation. We can't put the responsibility completely, and I know you didn't mean this, but can't put the responsibility completely on the women in the congregation. They have responsibility, but ultimately, it comes down to me to control my mind with God's help, and that can't be substituted.
Amen. I'll just say amen to that. There's always issues on both sides of the coin. I tell young ladies, if that's what it takes to get a husband, you're going to get what you deserve. And I say to young men, if that's what you're looking for, you're going to end up with what you deserve. And neither one is what you really want. Neither one is what you really want. One more? Who is it?
I'm not going to tell you who it is.
Okay, no, I'll call on you. Stan Estes from Martinsville, Indiana.
On church attendance, it's a church attendance is really a barometer. If church attendance is lacking, then we need to be focusing on the problem, not just on getting people inside the doors, but why they don't want to be inside the doors with the family.
Amen. Amen. And, well, Stan and I grew up in a church where they took attendance. They may still, I'm not sure, but and there's nothing wrong with that, but I remember growing up, many times people were disfellowshipped because of their attendance. And he is absolutely right. Attendance is important, but it's usually a symptom of an underlying issue. And it's that underlying issue that you need to get at to really solve that. And I couldn't agree with that comment anymore. Thank you, Stan.